Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, the president travels in Europe, deadly tornadoes across the Midwest, and a long sought-after fugitive will stand trial for Balkan war crimes. On his way to the G8, President Obama played the ancestry card and got a warm reception in Ireland, here in Dublin.
My name is Barack Obama of the Moneygall Obamas.
Hank Hamill of Joplin, Missouri, lost both his sons in a monster tornado. 3-year-old Ryan and 15-month-old Cole dead. It is heartbreaking.
We found my other son this morning, Ryan. He was floating in the water on the west side of the lake. It's a bad deal. I lost both of my boys.
And Serbian President Boris Tadic confirmed that Balkan war crimes fugitive Ratko Mladic had been arrested after all these years.
On behalf of the Republic of Serbia, I announce that today we arrested Ratko Mladic.
This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Kathy Obradovic of the Des Moines Register, Bruce Orwall of the Wall Street Journal, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join the conversation. What do you see in the twisters, the president's road trip in Europe, the GOP musical chairs for 2012. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. From Des Moines, Iowa today, Kathy Obradovic joins us. She's political columnist for the Des Moines Register. Kathy, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be here.
And from London, across the pond, Bruce Orwall joins us, London bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal, where President Obama has been hanging out in London. Bruce, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
And hello, Jack. Great to have you here, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Kathy, and Bruce.
Kathy, I've got to go straight to the storms and tornadoes out in your neck of the woods, south and all the way to Missouri, all the way down into Oklahoma. Huge numbers of dead there in Joplin, and big death tolls as well in Oklahoma. We just heard that father in Joplin, just heartbreaking to hear that. But what are people making of, first it was the south-southeast, now it's your neck of the woods just to the south there, Kathy. What are Iowans, what are Midwesterners thinking about what's going on here?
It's a terrible story in terms of human cost. And here in Iowa, we're no stranger to those kind of disasters.
Absolutely.
We had an E5 tornado in Parkersburg, Iowa in 2008. And, you know, one thing that folks in Joplin, Missouri can do is for some hope is to look at how well a town like Parkersburg was, in fact, able to pick itself up and go on after a huge disaster like this. I mean, there is actually a tomorrow after these kinds of things. And I think people in the Midwest are the types that pull together. They're stoic. They get things done. And they are going to move on from this.
They are the kind who pull together, and they are the kind who move on. But these storms have been historic in their scale and tough to pick up from. Here's Missouri Governor Jay Nixon talking with CNN's Anderson Cooper yesterday about his state's stretch to deal with the destruction and the enormous number of people still unaccounted for after those deadly tornadoes ripped across the region.
The locals have been stretched to a maximum here. That's why we've brought these additional resources in. We've got the entire Drug and Crime Patrol. I took one of my troops to Highway Patrol, plus our guard folks that'll be answering the phones. We'll use whatever resources are necessary. We're going to get these information out to these grieving families.
Jack Beattie, this has been some season. I mean, nature is powerful. We are always reminded. And we've got some unusual weather patterns this year with the jet stream and colder air coming down from the north. But just to watch week after week. And now Joplin, I mean, that, what, 100 and I don't know how many at this point. It keeps going up, the death toll there. This is enormous.
Yes, yeah, so just a headline in the Kansas City Sun, Joplin shredded, a town, a city, in a sort of sour coda to all this. House Majority Leader Eric Cantor put strings on the emergency relief package to go to Joplin, and this occasioned some criticism from Republicans in Missouri. He said that had to be paid for, and out of current taken out of something else, and the something else turned out to be a green energy program run by the Department of Energy. And this, the people, you know, Russ Carnahan, the Democrat from Missouri, said, you know, it's fine, let's have a debate on clean energy, but let's not put it on the backs of people in Joplin.
We've got a lot of politics to look at, but our hearts go out this week to all those who are struggling to pick themselves up, as Kathy says, from all those storms. I want to bring it across across the Atlantic to you, Bruce. President Obama having a good time there with generations back Irish ancestry, then toasting with the Queen, with the newlyweds at Buckingham Palace, and then midweek making a big speech to a joint session of the both houses of Parliament, unusual that, in Westminster Hall, where King Richard I were reminded at his coronation in 1189. They know history. Of course, history's moving on. He was thinking here in this bit of his speech about maybe China and India and rising powers, but saying that the U.S. and U.K. continue to have a big role in this changing world. Here's the president in London.
The time for our leadership is now. It was the United States and the United Kingdom and our democratic allies that shaped a world in which new nations could emerge and individuals could thrive. And even as more nations take on the responsibilities of global leadership, our alliance will remain indispensable to the goal of a century that is more peaceful, more prosperous, and more just.
We, he's saying there, U.S., U.K., indispensable. Bruce Orwell, take us into this. Did the British want, need to hear that?
Well, they really do need to hear it. If you live here for a while, anytime the U.S. President visits the U.K., there is a lot of hand-wringing about the status of the so-called special relationship with the U.S., which is something that every Briton knows a lot about and hears from the media about, and which, unfortunately, a lot of Americans don't realize that they're in a special relationship with the U.K. It's very amplified here, and so there's just a constant, you know, feel almost in, I hate to say it, but an insecurity among the Brits that they need to, you know, for the U.S. to demonstrate to them that they're, you know, that they're important still.
We'll jump across the channel and look at the G8 in Europe, but just to stick there in the U.K. for a minute, give us some of the texture of this week. You're right there in London. In Ireland, the crowd seemed pretty hepped up over the president and his recently discovered Irish root way back there somewhere, the Obama without the apostrophe. He was joking with them. But what about the rest of it and how the Obamas in particular were received?
Well, you know, in Ireland, it was almost like a campaign stop for a campaigning president. You know, you have obviously a lot of, you know, 20 some million Irish American voters in the U.S. And the image of the president going to Ireland and being received, you know, so rapturously as he was there, can only help going into 2012. And we are entering a sort of a campaign season. You know, on a day when the president normally obviously would have been on his way probably to Missouri to check out the damage there, he instead, was off to deal with business in Europe and wound up having this sort of over-the-top welcome by the Irish. In the U.K., you know, the days unfolded sort of first symbolically and then on to business. On the first day that the president was here, it was all about pomp and circumstance. He was greeted by the Queen. There was a big state dinner that night. He visited Westminster Abbey and laid a wreath to war dead. He showed up with the Prime Minister, David Cameron, at a school in South London, and they played ping pong together. They're trying to sort of send the message that these two guys are in it together, these two countries are in it together. On the second day, they got together and sort of talked more policy, talking about, primarily, you know, there aren't a lot of big issues between them right now, but we're talking about you know, trying to straighten out what the next leg of certain strategies are going to be, looking at Libya and the Arab Spring and how do you continue to foster the democracy movements in North Africa and the Middle East. Israel, of course, the successful removal from Afghanistan, which looms. So they basically, there's not a big overhaul in their relationship necessary, but they did a lot of fine-tuning and sort of plotting for the next steps.
I want to look at those policy issues, but what about just Obama and Cameron? I mean, here you've got President Obama, and we've seen the path that he's taken in terms of the financial meltdown and collapse and the efforts at comeback. Cameron, a conservative, gone a quite different way in the U.K. with his austerity program. Do they address that, Bruce, the almost polar opposite approaches they've taken to economic woe?
Well, it's not uncommon, first of all, for the American president and the British prime minister to overcome sort of ideological differences and try to put on a show of togetherness. You know, obviously, you had previously the labor leader here, Tony Blair, who was very close to the conservative Republican president, George W. Bush. So the relationship between the two countries is more important, I think, than, you know, than simply the politics of either of their parties. On the deficit issue, there are some areas, of course, where they disagree. And the David Cameron, the Tory leader here, I think was quite eager for the president to come in and endorse his austerity program, which, you know, involves much deeper cuts than really any place in the developed world to try to tame the deficit in the UK, which is massive. And the president at a press conference that was teed up for him, and he danced around it and wandered all over the place and never really came back to that endorsement that Cameron was looking for. Didn't embarrass his host, of course, but didn't say precisely what his host was hoping he would.
And Bruce, what about Libya? We've just got half a minute before the break, but does it look like NATO has the stomach, the resources to hang in there? President Obama seems to be moving the goalposts a little bit, or a lot. He wants seems to want Gaddafi out.
Well, I think he made another sort of shift forward in sort of how this thing has unfolded. Initially, all of the rhetoric from the White House was that this was sort of a temporary intervention. Then it was, we've got to get Gaddafi out. And now this week, the message very clearly was, this could take some time. You know, this is not necessarily a quick in and out sort of operation. And so patience, I think, was his message.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news this hour. Monster tornadoes, the president in Europe, GOP 2012 musical chairs, and an unexpected Democratic Party win in New York State, upstate New York. Lots on the table this week from the Mideast right into the Midwest in this country and its tornadoes. Let's get a caller straight in here. Mark in Acton, Massachusetts. Thanks very much for calling, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. There was quite a lot of anxiety earlier in the week, thanks to Bibi Netanyahu, who misrepresented what President Obama called for. He called for a Palestinian state that was independent and viable, based on the 67 lines, with mutually agreed upon swaps. And Netanyahu pretended that that was some novel and dangerous concept. The fact is that on November 11th of last year, Netanyahu, signed off on a joint statement with Hillary Clinton, which is up today on the Israeli Ministry of State website, which has the identical language. So this was a manufactured hissy fit by Netanyahu, who has previously bragged about the fact that he helped kill Rabin's peace proposals. And my question is this. Andrew Sullivan brought this to attention, saying, and he called Bibi a bald-faced liar and said how pathetic it is that so many fell for his hissy fit yet again. And I guess my question for your reporters is, did any of them know that he had taken the exact same position with the exact same language 6 months ago? And why do they believe that the news media failed to confront him about that and set the record straight?
Well, Mark, that's interesting. Let us look at it. I mean, it's not as though it hasn't been pointed out. I'm looking at the New York Times today in an editorial, and they're talking about the 67 border, saying the idea, 67 borders plus swaps, which would be, you know, land exchange for settlement land. Other land would go to Palestinians, I guess. The Times says the idea has been the basis of all negotiations for more than a decade, including those backed by President George W. Bush. So it's not as though it hasn't been noted. But it's interesting. President Obama, I guess, had something like the same thought as you, Mark, when he's talked at the AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, big pro-Israel lobbying group, on Sunday. He went straight to this point, and I happen to have that tape here. Let's listen. President here addressing criticism that he'd received for stating that the borders of a Palestinian state should be based on 1967 lines with mutually agreed swaps. Here's President Obama.
And since my position has been misrepresented several times, let me reaffirm what 1967 lines with mutually agreed swaps means. By definition, it means that the parties themselves, Israelis and Palestinians, will negotiate a border that is different than the one that existed on June 4th, 1967.
That's what mutually agreed upon swaps means.
Jack Petey, there's the president speaking to AIPAC and trying to make the point that, look, don't wrap me into 67 period. It's 67 plus swaps. But our caller's right that the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu did go very strong on the what he called the indefensible 1967 borders, didn't give much attention to the swaps. What's going on in this relationship, Jack? I mean, he's got politics at home to deal with as well, Netanyahu, but how do you see what's playing out here?
Well, he's got politics at home, and he got very good notices in the Israeli press for his speech to Congress. But he's also got politics here. He was invited here by John Boehner. He gave an address to the Joint House. He got joint houses. He got 30 standing ovations.
And, from the U.S. Congress, yeah.
From the U.S. Congress. And in the course of that speech, you know, he said that Israel was prepared to be generous on the question of territory for a Palestinian state. But he slammed the door, really, on Jerusalem, he slammed the door on the right of return for Palestinians, and he pledged to keep Israeli forces in the Jordan Valley. All of these things are anathema to the Palestinians, and in effect, President Obama, I think, was trying with that statement, which is the language the Palestinians like, to indicate perhaps we can do some sort of deal before this September, you know, UN vote, which may recognize a Palestinian state. Along comes Prime Minister Netanyahu, and he sort of stops that. It was strictly for domestic political consumption, and you really have to wonder. He seems to think that peace is the threat to Israel, not international isolation.
The Times, in that same editorial, saying today, this is more than a wasted opportunity. Continued stalemate feeds extremism, which, of course, costs everybody. If that vote comes up and it passes, which it seems it may well, and the U.S. is the veto on the Security Council that pushes back against it. But Benjamin Netanyahu, looking at the Palestinians and saying, look, they do not have their own house in order, in that speech before Congress, pushing back to the Palestinians on getting to negotiation. Here he is.
So I say to President Abbas, tear up your pact with Hamas. Sit down and negotiate. Make peace with a Jewish state. And if you do, I promise you this. Israel will not be the last country to welcome a Palestinian state as a new member of the United Nations. It will be the first to do so.
Kathy Obradovich, there in Des Moines, Iowa, you've got all kinds of politics bubbling in your backyard these days. And we'll look at what's hot there and what's not. But what about the Israeli-Palestinian issue and Middle East peace? As you look forward to the 2012 campaign, Netanyahu has politics at home to deal with. The United States has geopolitics to look at and deal with. What about American domestic politics and this issue? Is it a big one right now? Is it hot? Is it important or not?
It's an emerging issue. Most of what we've seen so far has been focused on really domestic policy. And here in Iowa, also social issues are important. But foreign policy is definitely emerging as a sort of a third important topic in the campaign, starting with the capture of Osama bin Laden and the activities now in the Middle East. But President Obama really did leave himself open for criticism on Israel. That basically half a line in his speech about the 1967 borders with agreed upon swaps became the immediate point for criticism from all of the Republican candidates who are hoping to run against him. You know, if this had been U.S. policy all along, or at least in the recent past, Obama could have done a better job of explaining that in his speech at the time.
Does that issue still resonate with evangelicals who are so big in the Republican caucus there in Iowa? It has in years past. Is it still a hot one?
Absolutely. Yeah. We have heard presidential candidates out here as Republicans saying, you know, we have a special relationship with Israel. There should never be any air at all between the United States and Israel. really piling it on as far as wanting to make it very, very clear that these candidates, you know, from Newt Gingrich on down, will absolutely maintain the historic special preference for Israel over Palestine.
And Bruce Orwell in London, let me ask you, I mean, if this vote goes ahead in the UN this fall to recognize a Palestinian state by the full General Assembly, there's a lot of talk that it may very well pass, and the U.S. may be alone out there vetoing it on the Security Council, unless President Obama could get some states or Europeans to, you know, to join him in opposition to it. What about this week in the U.K., in Europe? Does the president find support for pushing back on the Palestinian recognition, or is Europe likely to lean into it?
Not quite there yet on that point. So, you know, I think the thing we have here is just essentially that, you know, I think the president sees an opportunity to, you know, with all of the everything happening in the Middle East and, of course, the UN vote looming in September, an opportunity to try to sort of push forward and, you know, make some big steps forward toward long-term peace and security in the region. And I think he's trying to look down the field the way, the way a quarterback or a point guard would look up the field and try to, you know, sort of see what he needs to do to get where he wants to go.
But when you say not quite there yet, do you mean Europe is not ready to join him in resisting the recognition of this state? Or might Europe line up and just vote for it?
They might, yes. So I think what we've got is just, basically a very complex political situation, both domestically and internationally, that's unfolding and will be, as events this week, both in the U.S. and in Europe, demonstrate, it's going to be very complex to try to make that all fit together in the current timetable.
Big domestic politics this week, as we saw a Democratic victory in the traditionally very strongly Republican 26th district of New York. Kathy Hochul won there in a special election, and Medicare was the issue. We've got a call coming in from that neck of the woods. Let's go to North Tonawanda, New York, and Leonard. Hi, Leonard. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi there, Tom. Thank you, too. I was calling in just to express my opinion that the reason that Jane Corwin lost is that she scared the pants off of us. I am a Delphi salaried retiree, and I've lost my health insurance, and my pension has been severely cut back and turned over to the federal government. And I saw her supporting more efforts to do more of the same, to injure me and thousands of other people like me.
Leonard, so you're in the 26th district in New York. Were you surprised when the victor turned out to be a Democrat? I mean, the conservative vote presumably was split. There was a Tea Party candidate in there. Do you think it was the Tea Party candidate or this federal coverage Medicare issue that turned the tide?
It might have been the Tea Party candidate, because the difference between Jane Corwin and Kathy Hochul was only about 4 percentage points, and Jack Davis got 8 points, and I don't know where those 8 percentage points would have went. But
Jack Davis, the Tea Party candidate, but you were scared on the Medicare front, on the government front.
Absolutely. When I turn 62, I have no health insurance except Medicare, and I'm 56 now, and I'm retired, and I already lost my health insurance. Luckily, my wife works for the state university, so we have health insurance through them. But the attitude of the Jane Corwin-type people and the Republicans scares the pants off me.
Medicare has become a complicated issue for the Republicans. Maybe evidence of it right there in your neck of the woods, Leonard. Here's the Democratic candidate, Kathy Hochul. This was Tuesday, in her victory speech. She went right after, as she did all through the campaign, went after Republican Congressman Paul Ryan's budget plan and its Medicare elements, which had been a major issue in her campaign, that campaign.
We can balance our budget the right way and not on the backs of our seniors. But how about by closing corporate loopholes for companies that send jobs overseas? And how about ending government handouts to big oil? And here's one I think the voters of this district agree with. How about making millionaires and billionaires pay their fair share? And we can do all that and not decimate Medicare.
The surprise Democratic winner in the 26th district in New York, Jack Beatty, read the tea leaves here. What do you see?
Well, Democrats are euphoric. They point out that the New York 26 is ranked the 426th hardest district for Democrats to win. They say if we win there, we can win anywhere. Where does anywhere mean? Well, 47 House seats occupied by Republicans represent districts carried both by Barack Obama in 2008 and John Kerry in 2004. All the Democrats need to take control of the House is 24 seats. Those 47 Republican seats, they think, are highly vulnerable. And this has implications, they think, for presidential politics. A poll out of Pennsylvania just at the end of April showed President Obama with his job approval disapproved. He's disapproved by 20 points by independents, his job approval in Pennsylvania. But Pennsylvania is the second oldest state in the country. And this issue gives the Democrats, gives President Obama an opening there that looked to be going away from him. You know, the Republicans have come back and they've said, well, yeah, there was this third candidate. True. But the last two times that candidate ran, he ran as a Democrat, so that muddies the water there. And when the Republican ran in November, the fellow that took off his shirt and advertised himself and
blew himself right out of Congress.
Right, there you go. That guy won by 70. Republican got 72% of the vote. Even if you add all of Davis to Hochul, you come to 51 or so. That's still a drop of 20-some points, which it just can't be explained in any other way than as a Medicare. The Republicans would say a Medi-scare vote.
Kathy, we'll look at the Iowa politics here, but what about your Des Moines perspective on what happened in upstate New York?
Well, I think it shows how really difficult this issue is for Republicans. You look at a situation where a candidate like Newt Gingrich was scourged by federal Republicans or national Republicans for criticizing Paul Ryan's budget on Medicare. And yet you have a situation like this in New York where you see how it plays out in a general election. And, you know, we had our caller here who is 56, I think he said. And, you know, he would not have been affected by the Paul Ryan budget, which is looking at people who are 55 and older or looking at people 55 and younger. I'm sorry. So, you know, there's a lot of turmoil to be played out here. And I think that one thing Republicans are realizing is that while it's a very popular idea to get government out of health care on the Republican side, they have a lot of work to do to convince voters in a general election setting that that's a good idea.
But do we see now sort of a split screen on that even within the Republican Party, Jack? Do you have, you know, regretters in the ranks now about the vote on the Paul Ryan vote?
Well, you're hearing that The Hill and Politico this week have been full of stories with blind quotes, mostly Republicans expressing buyer's remorse. Why did we do it? They're saying there's a lot of anger at Speaker Boehner for making them take this vote. Even Mitch McConnell has said, well, tactically, he wondered about it since the Senate wasn't going to pass it. It does raise the question, well, why did they vote on it, knowing how risky it was? The Politico pointed out their consultants were telling him this could be poison. Why did they do it, even though they knew it wasn't going to go anywhere? And part of it was conviction. They said, we're going to cut the budget. This was a big cut. Part of it is ideology. Many simply don't, you know, they believe in individualism. They want people to be more responsible for their own health care. And part of it was interests. I mean, one of the things that's happened in recent years is that the insurance companies have got big time behind the Republican Party. They used to split more or less evenly, but with Democrats adopting health care reform, they've swung strongly to the Republicans, even strongly to the Tea Party. And, of course, the first Republican act was to repeal Obamacare, or to vote to repeal it. And this Ryan scheme would, of course, benefit private insurance companies. So it fits their interests.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, another big volcanic ash cloud out of Iceland snarled air traffic across Europe. Here's one passenger stranded at a Scottish airport.
But again, what can they do? They gave us letters, gave us vouchers for something to eat, but it's just hanging about now and waiting for buses, and that's it. It's just it's been a long day.
Vanishing shuttle moments from a spacewalk as astronauts Mike Fink and Gregory Chamatov admired the view of the Earth from outside the shuttle Endeavour.
great to be back outside. We have the most beautiful planet in the universe.
Nice view, isn't it?
Yes, we bet it is. And Lady Gaga's latest album officially out this week. Here's Americano. She's all over the place. We're looking at a week in the news, monster tornadoes, the president in Europe, GOP 2012, musical chairs, and more, with Kathy Obradovich, political columnist for the Des Moines Register in Iowa, Bruce Orwall with us from London, where the president spent time this week. He's London bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal. Jack Beattie is here. Let's go to Mark in Windham, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Talk about weeping. I want to say that I'm saddened beyond words by a sound clip of that man.
The sound of the father at the top of our show whose son was found in the lake and both boys gone. Didn't that just go to the heart?
Thanks for helping me out there.
I felt the same way. I felt the same way, Mark. That just, I mean, think of it. Both sons gone and just flown right out of the house.
I'm deeply dismayed, too, by certain optimistic responses that we hear at times like this. Things like, and we heard this today, they'll build, they'll move on. I can't fathom why we say things like that. Of course, people will rebuild, and of course the sun will come up, and the heart will keep beating, but we know that. I don't think it's worth saying, and I think it's really insensitive to say that.
You know, Mark, I hear you, and I certainly hear you on the father and those sons. No lack of sympathy whatsoever here, and certainly, I'm sure, not from Kathy Obradovich in Des Moines looking on. But at the same time, people, Kathy, I think, do take strength from those reassurances that they will rebuild. And maybe, I know what you mean, Mark, but at the same time, maybe it's most needed when it's most devastating, Kathy. I mean, because this is a real challenge. This, for Joplin and the people there and beyond, I mean, this is a heavy blow. They may need that reassurance that we will rebuild.
Yeah, absolutely. No disrespect intended to people who lost loved ones in this tragedy. What I was really trying to say is that really this community and a lot of Midwestern communities tend to come from a place of very deep faith. They have a lot of resources and personal strength to help them through tragedies like this. They will need help from the government, absolutely, but the primary thing that's going to be happening is that they're going to rely on each other to get through this. And what I was just really trying to point out is that we've had a recent situation here in Iowa with an E5 tornado a couple of years ago in Parkersburg. And in fact, despite the human tragedy there, they have recovered and moved on, not to say that they don't still mourn for the loved ones that they have lost, but just that it is sometimes hard to see that endpoint when you're standing amid the rubble.
Our sympathy fully there. And yes, the words of that father, absolutely heartbreaking. Beyond that, whatever gives hope to these towns and region, we send to them. Mark, I appreciate your call. Let me get another right here. Noreen in Amherst, New York. Noreen, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm calling as a person who voted in the 26th district.
Okay.
And I voted for Hochul. And
the Democrat with her surprise win. Yep, okay.
And I don't want to have the vouchers for the Medicare system because I'll be moving into that.
That's Paul Ryan's plan, yeah.
But I don't appreciate the Democrats, Hochul's demagoguery of the issue of Medicare. I mean, it sort of came from Obama. And where Representative Ryan gave Congress an opportunity to discuss what is needed for the future of our fiscal sovereignty. Here was a possibility. I think it was an honest attempt by Representative Ryan to say, okay, this is my plan, put out another plan, and we'll try to get something that will work. Because it'll be needed to go through Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security to have some sort of safety net in the future that won't completely dissolve.
Well, Noreen, I think you put your finger right on something so important here, because what we're up against is difficult. It's going to be hard. There isn't an easy answer. Now, Paul Ryan, like you, is saying there's been demagoguery here. He went after the Democrats after that vote for what he called their willingness to shamelessly distort and demagogue the issue. But let me ask you, Noreen, he's been called out on the other hand for saying, hey, with my plan, everybody's going to have just what members of Congress has, which does not look true on the face of it. So, I mean, everybody seems to want to try and gussy it up a little here, don't they, Noreen?
I don't know what Congress has, and I don't know what you mean by gussing it up.
Well, make sugarcoat what's coming, not be completely frank about what's out there. You know, maybe Paul Ryan hasn't been completely honest either when he says, "Oh, this is fine. Don't worry about it. You'll have just what we have."
Well, all I can say is that I think Ryan gave there an opportunity for Obama and the Republicans. I mean, actually, when Obama gave his speech right in front of Boehner and Ryan, he actually insulted them instead of saying, okay, let's have some sort of discussion on this issue. And I think despite all of the gussing up or whatever it might be,
mm-hmm.
that discussion needs to take place. I voted for Hochul because of her policies,
mm-hmm.
but I don't like Hochul's demagoguery, her scaring of people that this issue is going to be taken off the table.
Noreen, I appreciate your call. Kathy, let me bring this to you, because there's this issue of straight talk when the situation is difficult to stare straight at is a real live one this week in your neck of the woods. Tim Pawlenty coming out officially launching his presidential bid in your town, Des Moines, on Monday. And here he was, talking about, straight talk was one of his themes, even going after ethanol subsidies. Here's a bit from his speech, Tim Pawlenty.
We need to cut spending, and we need to cut it big time. The hard truth is there are no longer any sacred programs. The truth about federal energy subsidies, including federal subsidies for ethanol, is that they have to be phased out.
Those sounded like brave words in Iowa, corn country, ethanol country. Kathy, what about hard truth? How's it working in this campaign, early campaign season?
Well, this particular hard truth wasn't really quite so hard this year here in Iowa as it may have been in the past.
Tell us,
ethanol subsidies are no longer really a third rail of politics in Iowa. Earlier this year, Senator Charles Grassley, longtime Republican senator from Iowa, had already proposed cutting ethanol subsidies more than in half by 2012. The industry is willing to accept cuts in ethanol subsidies as long as other oil big oil gets their subsidies cut at the same time. So it's good politics to sound like you're telling a hard truth when, in fact, the risks of telling that truth are really kind of small. Now, I would say that's not necessarily the case with Medicare, and especially not major overhaul with Medicare. And I agree with the caller. It would be a real shame if people are scared away from talking about this. We need to talk about it in this campaign and decide how to ensure that Medicare is going to be here or some sort of health care help is going to be here for seniors in the future. I'm afraid that one of the things that this New York congressional race did really chilled the discussion of this for the 2012 race.
Kathy, take us on down the list of Republican contenders or potential contenders in 2012. You've got Pawlenty stepping up officially this week. Now, what about the rest of the crew who's sort of circling here? Michelle Bachmann, Mitt Romney, he's supposed to come out next week. Michelle Bachmann says she's going to make an announcement in June she's from Minnesota now, of course, but born in Waterloo, Iowa. What about Sarah Palin, Gingrich? What's happening, Kathy?
Yeah, the race is starting to gel a little bit, if not totally solidify here in Iowa. Beyond the candidates that you mentioned, there's several kind of lesser known candidates that are sort of vying for either the religious conservative or the Tea Party constituency. Herman Cain, who has made his race official. He's a former CEO of Godfather's Pizza, from Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And he has spent quite a bit of time in Iowa this year and seems to be popular on the Tea Party front and with people who are really anti-establishment. You mentioned Michelle Bachmann, and there was some talk that she might actually come out and announce while she was in Iowa this week. And in fact, she said no, she is going to wait a couple of weeks.
But wasn't it all but a signal that she's in?
She's, I would say, very, very close to saying that she's in. And, you know, you don't come to Iowa to announce that you're not running for president. But for her saying that she's going to come to Waterloo, Iowa, to make her announcement, it seems to tip her hand a little bit that she's seriously looking at running. Whether Sarah Palin and her sort of renewed activity toward a potential presidential race has any effect at all, Michelle Bachmann says no, it does not. But Sarah Palin candidacy would make it more difficult for Michelle Bachmann.
Does Sarah Palin have a support base in Iowa? Does she look like a, I don't know, viable, strong? What kind of candidate to you from Des Moines?
Most of the polls in Iowa among Republicans show Sarah Palin running about fourth behind Mitt Romney, behind Mike Huckabee, who's no longer in the race, and even in most polls behind Newt Gingrich. So she is not, she would not come into Iowa as the front runner. But she is popular. She draws crowds. Her celebrity helps her. Her money raising ability helps her. And so she would have an opportunity to, and not starting as a front runner in Iowa is not really a bad thing. Because you can start then to build a campaign without huge high expectations. So potentially she could actually start in Iowa fairly late behind the rest of the field and make a respectable showing here.
Newt Gingrich a little back on his heels this week after his comments on Medicare and the big pushback from the GOP the week before, and then the news of his $500,000 credit line at Tiffany's in Washington this week. Christian Science Monitor breakfast on Monday. The former Speaker of the House was insisting he's not a Washington figure.
It is impossible to have watched television for last week and not get to the conclusion I'm definitely not the candidate of the Washington Insiders.
I didn't ask that. I want to know how you're not that.
No, I'm just saying. When everywhere I go across Iowa, or everywhere I see people randomly, they have figured out I'm the guy who wants to change Washington, and they can tell it because the people they see on TV from Washington aren't happy with me. And the fact is, if you look at my platform, I will clearly be the most change-oriented, the most fundamental reform candidate in this race in either party.
Talk about making a purse out of a sow's ear, Jack. Big trouble, and then he's not the Washington guy. What do you think of the GOP gang lining up, shaping up here, Jack?
Well, Newt has had a very bad week. He, according to a PPP poll just released, he's had a 27-point swing in his favorability, unfavorable rating among GOP voters. 27 points in a week. And the Tiffany connection just continues to resound, and it led to a classic line of Stephen Colbert's that the former speaker buys jewelry, buys engagement rings by the wholesale in order to be ready for further marriages. So it's been a bad week for him. And then Sarah Palin, I find all that very interesting. She's going to take a tour on her bus. She's going to come here into New Hampshire. She's rehired some staff. She's got a two-hour biographical film opening in where else? Iowa. So she looks like she's running. On the other hand, Fox announced yesterday that their agreement with her has not changed. That's a signal that she hasn't indicated to them that she's running. When Gingrich and Santorum did, they lost their contracts with Fox. Huckabee didn't, and he stayed out of the race. So that might be an indication that she's going to use this to drum up publicity for herself and her enterprises, but not run for president.
Kathy Obradovich, we've got a lot of unhappiness on Facebook postings here and online at onpointradio.org about the just before midnight auto signing from Europe by the president of the renewal of the Patriot Act. Another 4 years here. A lot of pushback saying, what about the Constitution? What about civil liberties? Of course, we saw Rand Paul, the senator from Kentucky, resisting. But in the end, there it is. Is this a live political issue in Iowa, or are people accepting it as that's what it takes for security?
I think that Barack Obama signing that will make some of his more liberal base unhappy. And certainly that is a segment of the party here in Iowa.
What about conservatives, the Rand Paul kind of conservative?
It probably upsets the fringes on both sides a lot more than people in the middle. People in the middle are probably still giving him a little bit of credit on the fighting terrorism front. In fact, the fact that there has not been a successful major terrorist activity here in the United States since the really since 9/11, but since the passage of the Patriot Act as well, it gives a little bit of cover for him to make the argument that this is the legislation that is working.
Speaking of terror, Bruce Orwell, let me come back to you there in London. This capture of Ratko Mladic this week. Of course, during the Balkan War, he was quite a figure, the big general in charge of Serb forces there in Bosnia, and not long before it finally came to an end, those 8,000 men and boys, hands behind their back, shot point blank, buried mass graves in the woods all this now to be laid on him. He's finally captured. What does it mean for Europe, for the Balkans, but for Europeans overall, Bruce, to see this capture?
Well, of course, anytime, you know, whether it's bin Laden or an event like this, you know, anytime, you know, one of these terrible figures in history is brought to justice, it, you know, it brings emotional relief. It's sort of a moment when everybody feels like we can put the past behind a bit and move forward. In this particular case, it's a little bit more complicated than that for Serbia, at least, because there's a whole underlying subtext to this event of his arrest that has to do with Serbia's candidacy for the EU, which they would like to join.
Which was being held up by the fact that he was kind of hiding in plain sight for many years.
Well, you know, I mean, there's this notion, you know, similar to the with the Pakistanis and bin Laden, that perhaps they knew where he was, and the timing of this is like sort of brought into to improve their chances of joining the EU. They've been seen as dragging their feet in cooperating with the tribunal in The Hague, which deals with the war criminals. And so you might say, some people are saying this is a tactical event as well as an emotional one for the region.
He will stand trial there now. He may have already paid his daughter, Anna, reportedly so distraught by reports about what her father had done that she committed suicide with his favorite pistol in 1994. Tough story, but he is now in custody. Bruce Orwell with the Wall Street Journal in London, thank you for joining us. And Kathy Obradovich at the Des Moines Register, great to have you here. Jack Beattie, have a great weekend. Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.